So, today we are continuing our discussion of the precepts, and specifically, we're reading a chapter called Taking Refuge in the Three Treasures by John Didelori in his book, The Heart of Being, Moral and Ethical Teachings of Zen Buddhism. So we'll go ahead and read the whole chapter.
Taking refuge in the three treasures, waking up. When I listen to the precepts, the vows, and the service dedications, when I feel my body in the bows, when I connect with the Buddhas and the ancestors in the daily liturgy, I am touched by an incredible sense of gratitude for having the opportunity to hear, experience, and participate in these teachings at this time. I know it is a gift I will never be able to repay. It makes me wonder how often any of us appreciates how profound this practice is. Do we really hear it? Do we sense it? Do we feel it with our bones, right down to the marrow, with every cell in our bodies? Or is it just another fling, a Dharma fling? It is vitally important to appreciate this life. In one sense, that is what taking refuge in the three treasures really is about, appreciating our life, appreciating all life, waking up again and again to that feeling.
People ask, how can I deepen the teacher-student relationship? It is like asking, how can I love you? Is there a book of instructions on how to love? Does a baby get taught how to love its mother, the flowers, the earth, and the rain? In Zen training, we say, really put yourself into it. But what does that mean? It means to take refuge and to be protected by the three treasures. What are the three treasures? We chant, being one with the Buddha, being one with the Dharma, being one with the Sangha. These are the three treasures. But what does it mean to be one with? This is what we need to see, realize clearly and personally. The way we use the word refuge is taken from the Japanese term kie. Kie consists of two characters. Ki means to unreservedly throw oneself into. No holding back, no way out, no safety net, harness, or rope. That is the way you work with a koan, unreservedly. That is the way that a parent rescues a child who is in danger. The parent does not think about himself or herself. The parent does not hesitate for one second. The second character, A, means literally to rely upon, in the way that a child leaps into a parent's arms, trusting unequivocally.
I remember when my children were young. They were able to stand by themselves, but couldn't yet walk. And I would stand them up on the dresser and say, jump. They would throw themselves into space, knowing I would be there. They had a complete sense of trust and unwavering commitment. It was total doing, unreservedly throwing oneself into and relying upon, differs from a shelter or protection from danger or distress. The more common definition of the word refuge. Before we can appreciate kie, we need to appreciate what it is we are relying upon and unreservedly throwing ourselves into. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Usually we understand Buddha to be the historical Buddha. From an inclusive perspective, we say that all beings are Buddha. Also, Buddha is the teacher. We see Dharma as being the teachings of the Buddha, the medicine to heal the sickness, and sometimes it is the 10,000 things. We understand Sangha as the practitioners of the Buddha's Dharma, our champions along the way, and we also understand it as a whole phenomenal universe, all sentient beings. agree to go.
Make a note that he just threw in the word 10,000 things. And that means all the myriad things. So 10 is like a shorthand for all the stuff. The whole phenomena.
Then there is a much deeper way to appreciate these three treasures. Perhaps if we appreciate them deeply enough, we will realize what it means to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, to vow to save all sentient beings, to put an end to desires, to master the Dharmas, and to accomplish the way. Perhaps we will understand what it means to be one with this unwavering lineage of ancestors who have handed down this Dharma from generation to generation without holding anything back. They gave their lives to it, not 3 months, 6 months, a year, 5 or 10 years, but their whole lives. They turned themselves inside out. They renounced everything else to make the way clear. Why? So we can have it, here and now, served to us on a platter. It is ours for the taking. All we have to do is reach out. What does it mean to reach out? It means to have exhaustively asked questions. What is Buddha? What is Dharma? What is Sangha? What does it mean to take refuge? What does it mean to vow? What does it mean to be one with? What does it mean to commit? What does it mean to have a relationship with a teacher? The answers are all available. Nothing is hidden.
We can find it in books. We can find it in the sutras. We can find it by asking. And most important, we can find it simply by looking into ourselves. Why do we practice? What is it that we seek? What is it that we want? What is it that we are prepared to do to get what we want?
Are we willing to practice the edge, take a risk, unreservedly throw ourselves into practice? Or are we just being opportunistic and calculating, ready only to skim a little cream off the top to take care of the immediate problems, but not ready to go to the depths? The three treasures can be seen in many different ways. One way of understanding them is as the unified three treasures. The Buddha treasure, from the perspective of the unified three treasures, is Anattara Samyak Sambodhi, perfect enlightenment. No one is without it. It does not increase one bit in Buddhas, nor is it reduced one bit in ordinary beings. It is our fundamental nature, the fundamental nature of each and every one of us. It is the essential reality of this great earth and of the universe. It is vast. It is empty. It is without self-nature. The virtues of the Dharma of wisdom and liberation emerge from Anattara Samyak Sambodhi. It is from here that we realize the three bodies of the Buddha, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. From the perspective of the unified three treasures, the Dharma treasure is undefiled purity. There is neither a speck of defilement nor a single particle of ego in the Dharma treasure. The Dharma reaches everywhere. There is nothing outside it. Where could the defilement possibly come from? Dharma embraces everything. It is for that reason it is pure and undefiled.
From the perspective of the unified three treasures, the Sangha treasure is virtue and merit of harmony. What we call harmony is really the fusion of the Buddha treasure and the Dharma treasure. Buddha, or fundamental nature, is empty of all characteristics, yet there is an arising of karma, cause, and effect, which is Dharma nature. There is this arising of causation, or Dharma, yet fundamental nature is empty. This vital matter is the life of each one of us. Another way of looking at the three treasures is as the manifested three treasures. Direct realization of Bodhi is called the Buddha treasure. Buddha was the first person to realize Bodhi. Each generation thereafter has rekindled that realization as personal experience. Enlightened masters opened their eyes and transmitted it from generation to generation, from country to country. That is the manifested Buddha treasure. The Dharma of the manifested three treasures is the Buddha's realization. That realization of the Buddha is at once the realization of all sentient beings, past, present, and future, your life and my life. The Sangha of the manifested three treasures is the practicing of the Buddha's Dharma. The moment two people get together and practice, not just go through the gestures, take the form, use the vernacular, or dress in the clothing, but practice with heart, mind, and body, with commitment, vow, and dedication, with great faith, great doubt, and great determination, then you have the manifested Sangha treasure. Everything else is a cheap imitation. It just looks like the real thing.
Three treasures, converting devas and liberating people, appearing in vast space or in a speck of dust, is the Buddha treasure of the abiding three treasures. To abide means to preserve and protect. We need to appreciate that our practice is not only about our own realization, about relieving our own pain and suffering, it is also about relieving the pain and suffering of all beings. We should never lose sight of that. We remind ourselves every night of the fact at the monastery by reciting the Bodhisattva vows. We are the vessel of the Dharma at this time and this place. What we do each sitting, each moment, with our work, with our zazen and services, with our vows, not only affirms and verifies the enlightenment of the Buddha and all the past Buddhas, but also preserves and protects the Dharma so it will be available for future generations. We are part of the transmission of the Dharma from east to west. It goes from place to place only through people. Only a Buddha can realize Buddha. Only a Buddha can practice Buddha Dharma. Only a Buddha is a vessel of Dharma. All sentient beings are Buddhas. All Buddhas are sentient beings. What we do, therefore, is no small thing. Our actions have far-reaching consequences. The karma of taking refuge, of making the vow to save all sentient beings, vowing to realize oneself, to practice zazen, to nurture the mountains and rivers, to work in the garden. All of it is part of the legacy that has come down to us for 2,500 years and, it is hoped, will continue 2,500 years into the future. If it does, it is because of how we take care of it.
We include in the abiding Buddha treasure those Buddhas made of wood, metal, stone, and paint. All of them are manifestations of the infinite, boundless Buddhas present in the myriad realms. Each of these Buddhas is presently expounding the Dharma, converting and saving all beings, healing and nourishing all beings, according to the karma of circumstances. Do we really understand the truth of that statement? The wooden Buddha on the altar is expounding the Dharma according to karma. How do we understand that? Common sense is not going to help us here. Scientific knowledge is not going to help us. There is another realm of human experience involved. What does it mean to bow to the Buddha, specifically to that wooden Buddha on the altar? A monk asked Chao Chu, "What is Buddha?" Chao Chu said, "He's on the altar." What did Chao Chu mean? How is that piece of wood a Buddha? Is that painting a Buddha? Do not separate yourself from anything. Do not separate yourself from Mu. Do not separate yourself from the chanting, from your vow, from your commitment, from each other, from this whole great earth. transformed into the sutras and converted into the oceanic storehouse, the Dharma of the abiding three treasures delivers the inanimate and animate, saving all beings. That was a quote. Not sure where it's from. What are the sutras? The spirit of these precepts, the spirit of the sutras, the spirit of this discourse goes far beyond the words. We cannot reach them with our analytical minds alone. This teaching is dark to the mind. We have to sense it with our heart, our feelings. The Sangha of the abiding three treasures is saving all beings from all suffering, releasing them from the abode of the three realms, the realms of desire, form, and formlessness. In order to save all beings from suffering, we need to put an end to the three poisons of greed, anger, and ignorance. Having appreciated the three treasures from three different perspectives, we need to appreciate the unity or oneness of these three perspectives. Each interpenetrates the other. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha completely merge in our one reality. What is that reality? This Dharma is incredibly profound and infinitely subtle. Because of its profundity and subtlety, it requires whole body and mind engagement for it to communicate. Taking refuge is not a matter of casual encounter. This is a whole body and mind vow, whole body and mind unity, whole body and mind commitment. Those who give that much realize it. Those who do not realize it. Some may realize it, some may not. Either way is okay. It is up to us. Nobody can do it for us. Buddha could not do it for us if he were here. Only we have the power to take advantage of the personal karma that has placed us in this time and place. It is a unique opportunity, and how we use it is totally in our hands. In order to reach our full human potential, we must live completely and die completely. In order for this practice to function, it needs to be engaged. It does not happen automatically because we wrap a rakusu around our neck, put on a robe, attend a retreat, or read a book on Zen. Okay, I'm here. Now do me, Dharma. It does not happen that way. We have to work for it. We have to put ourselves in the line. We have to practice the edge of our life in order to receive the Dharma. Undeniably, it is here. We are surrounded, interpenetrated, enveloped, and swallowed by it. But most of us are blind and deaf to it. We do not see it, we do not hear it, we do not feel it. When will we wake up? So that was definitely not a chapter explaining the three treasures. That was a...
extended meditation.
That was a meditation on the three treasures.
On the nature of the three treasures.
It started there.
So even in our Kyoji Kaimon, our reading about the precepts, which I usually hand out, but I didn't today, it talks about these three different levels of the three treasures. So the first being basically kind of at that grand, grand level, the most abstract. The ancient masters say it better than I do. At the source, the highest truth is called the Buddha treasure. Immaculacy is called the Dharma treasure. Harmony is called the Sangha treasure. In the past, those who realize the truth completely are called the Buddha treasure. The truth realized is called the Dharma treasure. Those who have transmitted this Dharma are called the Sangha treasure. In the present, those who teach devas and humans in the sky and in the world are called the Buddha treasure. That which appears in the world and in the scriptures becoming good for others is called the Dharma treasure. They who release their suffering and embrace all beings are called the Sangha treasure.
questions?
My journey into these three treasures, I think, is sort of, it sort of feels like I sort of found the Dharma, took refuge in the Dharma first as something that made sense to me, that in my life it made sense, and from there I think then I kind of started to take refuge in the Buddha. But it was many years before I really, I found myself knowingly taking refuge in the Sangha. And it was, things had gotten very difficult. It was like, I don't know what to do. I will go to the Sangha. And that for me was sort of taking refuge that I had never, a piece of it that I had never seen. Getting these various readings remind me of how much there is around this that I still need to figure out how it fits in.
Yeah, I remember similarly, reading about Buddhism and Zen and trying out meditation and going, cool. The Dharma, the teachings, the method, And then the Buddha kind of, as I started to experience some clarity, kind of recognizing, awakening, more awakeness is possible, kind of that principle to me of that beings can wake up, seem to be embodied in the Buddha. Okay, so like, and then I was like, well, what's this Sangha thing? Like, I remember feeling no personal necessity for it, but I liked the Dharma enough, and the Dharma told me that I needed it. So it said, you got these, I got two of them, so I guess, and then I just looked in the phone book. So it's like, I guess I gotta find that.
You mean to tell me, so you found awakening, at least the glimmer of it, before you joined the Sangha?
Yeah, I mean, just in small ways, just in, I'd sit and meditate and kind of, I'd get some insight into, my relationship with my partner and how, that's why that happens, because I react like that. I mean, just kind of that, And I had never, that was a very radical thing for me. I just felt like, I was stuck. I was just stuck in dysfunctional patterns and there was nothing I could do about it. I just had this personality, I had these flaws, I had, so life is just going to suck, But then this method of actually, and I actually felt some clarity and some change, some possibility. So it wasn't, it wasn't a radical transformation, but just enough to go, hey.
So you have a science background, and when he talks about this is not something you can reach with your mind, there's different ways to... you just have to have a different way to access these teachings. Does that kind of like bother you at all?
Well, it, I guess in the sense that it doesn't come naturally. I mean, I'd rather, sit over on the side and think about things, then go out there and dance and bungee jump. I feel like this is kind of, it's not just that this is a body practice as opposed to a mind practice. It's a, like you said, that whole, you have to do it, you have to go
into it completely, wholeheartedly, with everything. So that kind of, well, but I also have a lot of passionate emotions, which I think kind of drew me into that kind of participation. But I think we haven't completely jumped off the dresser into the father's arms. We're still kind of, holding on, just a little bit something back there.
It's weird because, how can you jump into something that you don't know what it is?
Yeah.
And that's like when that's something I still struggle with is when I didn't know what it was and I thought maybe it wasn't even real, I was almost a little easier to be more wholehearted about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw it could change me, then I was like, whoa. Or seeing other people were changed and being convinced of it. This is real and powerful. I don't know what's doing.
Then you really jump.
No. What's it going to do? Where am I going to land?
And are we even capable? I mean, I don't think any of us is actually even physically capable of jumping off that dresser the way that a child can. We just can't. Mm-hmm. I mean, our minds, our experience, our views, just... maybe not can't, but it's it takes a lot of work of letting go, clarifying, and making little jumps.
Yeah.
I feel like the little jumps and realizing, okay.
Yeah.
It's almost like you have to be in a monastery to do that kind of wholehearted practice.
Apparently not, because I know a lot of people who haven't spent any significant time in a monastery and they've done it.
You do have to.
I think it helps. Mm-hmm. Just can help.
Mm-hmm. I think the issue for me living an ordinary life outside of a monastery is it can be a little more difficult to commit the time and energy and effort because there are so many excuses not to. And I think that for me is what makes it more difficult living a lay life is that, I can find so many other things to do. Spend the time and the effort and the clarity.
I think, Brandon, just keying off what you were saying, I think there's an element of faith to this that I don't know that we always, well, I'll speak for myself, I don't know that I always recognize or give it sort of the power it deserves. But I do think that there's only so much you can intellectualize, and then there's a leap of faith that, even if it's tiny steps, that maybe if I continue this, something good will come of it. Because you're right, who knows what's on the other side entirely. Sharon Salzberg wrote a whole book on this, called Faith. And it goes into depth around this very issue, and I found it fascinating.
Faith, what did she say? It's the absence, the opposite of faith is despair. But when...
It's not the same as belief.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's that willingness to give it a try.
Moment by moment.
Yeah.
I've been just beginning Pema Chodron's book, The Places That Scare Us, where she talks about bodhicitta, the idea of the open heart, right? Would you say that's a little bit analogous?
Yeah, because the way this is envisioned, in the Kyoto Kaimon, is that first bodhicitta arises.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing that happens is this hoping intuition, maybe, that there might be another way a longing, a refusal to continue exactly how you are. So it's like that, it starts with that, and then you look and you see that your life and your actions and your behavior are not perfect. If they have caused suffering for self and other, and then you, there's that contrition arises, I want to try a different way. And then you take refuge. So I think you're right. It's that longing arises, and then what do you do? Then that's kind of like propels you off that cliff. So I think that's kind of what got me to keep on. You know, it's never felt like jumping in. It's felt like, I like the analogy better of that Chosen gave at the Rahatsu, where it's like, if enlightenment's like the ocean, and if you've never seen the ocean before, when you, even just seeing it, you're going to be like, whoa. So like, and then, you know, if you're stepping, if you're moving gradually toward, you know, swimming in it, you know, you're gonna go up to it, you're gonna, you know, put a toe in it, you're gonna, you know, get up to your feet, oh, that's cold! You know? So that's like that gradual step by step, but at each point there is that sense of like, I don't know what's gonna happen, but it seems worth the risk.
I think it may be like you can't really go jump full off and do it anyway, because am I going to jump off that cliff or that cliff or that cliff? Like, what am I jumping into? Like, you have to see, you have to, like, it's a path, right? And you can see down the road a little bit, and you're like, I'm going to go, maybe you can go wholeheartedly towards the next
corner.
Yeah, it's kind of an illusion. Like, you know, you're still a mile off from the ocean, and it's like, I'm gonna jump right in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my own practice, I haven't found that it's linear either. Mm-hmm. You know, the analogy of the path is sometimes not all that useful for me. Yeah. For me, it's been back and forth at times, mm-hmm. instead of like continuing down. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's been going that way, where there is not really the path anymore, and all kinds of other things.
All the analogies end up falling apart.
They do.
But here's another one, which I kind of like, which is it's a path that's going up a mountain, but it's going up around like this.
Circular.
And so, and if you kind of picture like a real path, and most of the time you really can't see anything, you're just treading up. But then, like, you come to a viewpoint, and also there's a, that also talks about kind of that cyclic aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Where, like, you know, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm in the same place. Yeah. But then when you know, you get a little view and you realize it isn't quite the same place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm not quite in the same place as I was before.
Yeah.
I found that with the holidays, because I didn't notice any change in myself at all, and then the holidays came, I feel like, remember exactly how I felt last Christmas, and like where I was at.
Because
those, somehow the holidays, the ritual, mm-hmm. brings about the whole context, the feeling and everything. I was like, oh, cool. Whoa.
Yeah, because I mean, in that gradual sense, you don't necessarily notice what's changed. But. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to read a little piece about Sangha. The same lady who has dogs in her Zendo edits on her website. So this is from Dogen. This is from the Shobo Genzo's Mimonki. So he wrote the Shobo Genzo, which is, you know, 90 chapters. It tends to be 4 volumes long, dense, poetic, esoteric kind of teachings. And the Shobo Genzo's Mimonki are his lectures to his monks. So it tends to be really like sweet and practical. Mm-hmm. I mean, the others were lectures to his monks also, but he also wrote them and revised them and all that. So he said, "Do not worry about the small number in this Sangha. Do not mind that you are a beginner. At Funyo, there were only 6 or 7 people. At Yakusan, there were less than 10. Nevertheless, all of them practice the way of the Buddha's ancestors. This is called the flourishing of the monasteries. The condition of practicing the way is also like this. This way is inherent in each of us. Still, our gaining the way depends on the help of co-practitioners. Though each person is brilliant, still, our practicing the way needs the power of other people in the Sangha. Therefore, unifying your mind and concentrating your aspiration, practice and seek the way together. A jewel becomes a vessel by polishing it. A human being becomes benevolent and wise by refining it. What jewel glitters from its inception? Who is brilliant from the outset? You must polish and refine, so do not demean yourselves and do not relax in your practice of the way." Do not worry about the small people in this song. Isn't that sweet that, like, Dogen actually gave that little lecture? Do not mind that you are a beginner. And then I'm assuming these are famous monasteries that he's talking about that only had just a handful of people. This was called the flourishing of the monasteries. Yeah. Again, like I guess like Dido was saying, you know, if you're sincerely practicing together, then Sangha is created. I was just thinking today about somebody came in, I hadn't seen her before. Apparently he left, you know, before service. And it makes me think of, you know, any of us, I mean, you may have already had this experience, but any of us can go to just about any major city in the country and find a little Soto Zen place, mm-hmm. and walk in and, like, I don't know about you, but, you know, I'm out and about, and when I walk into a Zendo, I know it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be some cushions, some seizo benches, and some zafus, and there's going to be a little altar, and you just be like, ah, oh, I know what I do care. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's home. It is a home place.
Yeah. And it's just it's really a treat when you realize, okay, you have a home place, but then you have little home places all over the world that you can go, and they'll have that same kind of familiar flavor, have kind of an extended sangha also. And the sangha, you know, the way that I describe it in my book is just, I think of sangha in a way as including all of these things that we create together, places, teachings, traditions, community, chanting. I just loved it all in that sangha chapter, because that's the essence of it. Matter of fact, that's my favorite aspect of chanting, is it's just something that we're doing together. Mm-hmm. Not that it's, you know, it's not necessarily my favorite form of practice or meditation, but you know, we've all been just doing our meditation quietly, and now we do something together, and that's really sweet. All right, well, it's afternoon, so thank you all for coming.
So Sangha will help knock the you know, knock off pieces of us to help polish us.
another analogy. It's like a rock tumbler.
Yeah.
Sharp rocks, and you just go like this, and then they all get polished. Or washing potatoes like that. Have you ever done that?
What?
If you have a whole bunch of potatoes to wash, you put them in a big sink bin with water, and then you just go like this, and they get like perfectly clean just by bumping up against each other.
Oh no!
I mean, you generally only find those things out at a monastery when you're washing 50 potatoes at one time.